This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is your typical radio ad while eating a Crunch Bar.
This is Automatic of Otto's Used Cars. This weekend only, we're having a whale! Bring the kids. See for yourself. It is huge. Gonna make a big splash. No other dealer can say they have a whale like this.
When things sound dull, turn up the fun with Crunch.
Welcome to the School of Influence podcast, where the queen and king of influencer marketing, authors and professors Amanda Russell and Neil Schaefer, cut through the noise and dissect what makes brands and professionals influential. No fluff, just the real deal.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the School of Influence podcast. Something that we don't talk a lot about on this podcast, but is critical to understanding the mindset behind influencer marketing is the science behind influence. And today we have a very special guest, really one of the thought leaders in the space, who is going to school us on the science of influence. Amanda, I'll hand it over to you.
Yes, Pranav is the founder and CEO of NeuroInsight US. He's also an international innovation and thought leader dedicated to bringing a deeper understanding of human motivation to the forefront using neuroscience. He's also an investor. He's an advisor. He's won countless awards, including ARF Great Mind Award, Ad Club New York's Advertising People of the Year, AMA 40 Under 40 Emerging Leaders, Ad Age 40 Under 40, to name a few. He's spoken at the United Nations, Cannes Lion Festivals, on Creative Advertising Week, South by Southwest, CES, Forbes Summits, Business Schools. And the list can go on and on, but I'm going to let him tell the story, because there's no shortage in his bio of influential forces of some of the major companies and people that he's aligned with. So Pranav, thank you so much, first of all, for making the time for us today to share some of your knowledge and insight. I'm really excited to hear a little bit more about your journey and how you did get here.
Well, thank you. The pleasure is mine. It's an absolute honor to be talking to both of you and sharing whatever little I can. So I can start off telling you my story and how I got to be doing what I'm doing. You know, this is a podcast, so people can't see it. But if you put an image of me, most people would guess that I, given my blonde hair and blue eyes, I'm from Sweden, which would make more sense when they look at my image and they're hearing this. I was born in India. You know, India was rather socialist till about 7 years of age. We had one brand of cola, one channel on TV. My parents worked in the healthcare system as doctors and lived a very fulfilling life. And the world that I know today was very foreign to me. In fact, I didn't even have dreams of being in this world purely because my imagination or the subconscious hadn't been fed the idea of this world. I was about 15 years old when I read an ad in the newspaper that said the Singaporean government was going to pick 30 kids from India to send them to boarding school in Singapore. So as an enthusiastic 15-year-old goes, I took a cutout of that and filled out an application. And long story short, I got very lucky and ended up in boarding school in Singapore, where I took my Cambridge A-levels. And through, again, miracle of nature, I was looking at liberal arts colleges in America and wrote to all of them. And one of them had one scholarship that's given out to one kid from India every few years. And again, got lucky and showed up in America in a town called Northfield, Minnesota, where when you actually take that exit, it says, "Welcome to Northfield, Minnesota, a town of cows, colleges, and contentment." And I thought I'd left the cows and contentment behind in India. But here it was in Northfield, Minnesota, where I went to college. I triple majored in mathematics, physics, and economics, only to then realized that I had been very lucky studying on these scholarships all of this while and be going to some of the top schools in the country. Except when I graduate, I'm back to square one. I don't have any family in the country or so anybody to rely on. So, you know, making money was the first thing that would provide the security net. And so I decided to go to Wall Street. I was a structured equity derivatives trader at Goldman Sachs, if that means anything to you or to your listeners. If it doesn't, I don't think it's worthy of, you know, to be looked up. So just to understand, there's a complicated financial product, only for me to then realize that this is not where I found meaning. So I quit at the peak of recession in 2009 to then work for a Danish innovation strategy consulting firm, where my first project was to go to India and figure out why, despite it being 120 degrees in the summer, Indians don't buy air conditioners. My second project was to go to Copenhagen and look at data from about 150 cities across 250 variables to decode what has made cities fail in the past and how do we design a city for the future. And my last project was to look at gaming all over the world and decode why gamers game and use that information to design gaming for the future. So the crux of all of that work was social scientific research and using tools provided to us by social sciences to decode behavior. And it was during that time that I realized that human decision making is very different from what people actually state. Doing ethnographies, talking to people, we realized that what people said in the first hour was different to what they said in the second hour. It was completely contradictory to what they said in the fourth hour. So relying on stated behavior or facts or decision making wasn't correlating to in-market behavior anyway. So how are we spending these trillions of dollars of years in new products, innovations, let alone marketing, advertising, and packaging? And we have these sayings in the industry where they say like 50% of my marketing dollars go to waste. I just don't know 50%. But no one's done anything to be able to solve that. And that's what got me interested in the idea of understanding the subconscious, where the decision-making happens. And I ended up starting NeuroInsight US back in 2010. So it's been 11 years of studying the brain to decode behavior.
Gosh, it's so fascinating because I think there's so many of the projects that you just said. I'm sure Neil's thinking the same thing. Where it's like, well, we could do a whole podcast on. So like, how did you plan the city, the new city of the future? And why don't the Indians do air conditioning? What was that motivation? But, you know, to fast forward more to the topic of the episode is what, like looking at neuroscience. So it's such a big topic in marketing because, and something that is one of the biggest challenges is that marketing is not, it's not that simple because humans are not that rational or linear in their thinking. And so when we look at the forces of influence, we're confusing it with popularity and buzz and people and companies that have all of this popularity really, which doesn't necessarily convert. And even if you ask somebody what was the decision that they made, why did they make that decision? Even if they're honest, they probably are still not telling you all the 17 different reasons that really affected their decision. In short, it's not directly attributable. So what is it that you do now? Like who's your audience? How do we use you? And what do you think is the problem in influencer marketing right now? And how somebody that doesn't have, say, an Amazon style budget can benefit from neuroscience and neuromarketing?
Sure. I mean, while you're absolutely true that behavior understanding is nuanced, I'll also say that people who inherently understand what it takes to convince another party or to use the right set of motivating principles, myths, stories, songs, rituals, have done this for thousands of years. So neither is the problem new, nor is the solution new. The tools are new. The tools of communication are new. The tools of measurement are new. So, but what the problem and the solution, neither one of which is new. So let's start with, you know, decoding what is it that happens in the brain that makes this happen, and then we'll get into the tool itself and how we use that. So 90%, and this is not me saying it, this is the past 5,000 years of philosophy and the past 100 years of neuroscience that have proved that 90% of decision-making takes place in the subconscious. So I'll pause for a second.
I'm writing this down, by the way.
And let your audience digest that. Subconscious, by definition of the word itself, is below sub, your conscious awareness. So you yourself consciously, when you try to think what you're going to do or how you're going to make a decision, are 90% of the time unaware of why you made that decision. And this is not our audience, the target audience, the customer. This is everybody at all points in their lives. Okay, that's point number one. Point number two is, you know, while in pop psychology, which I have a huge issue with, and we can do another episode on that if you'd like, where, you know, marketers love using stuff like red wine is good for you one day and bad for you one day, and the left hemisphere of the brain does this and the right does that. I'm like, I think those are mostly just excuses that people use at bars when they meet another person, saying, oh, I am so right brain, I can't do math because I can't calculate the tip on this check, which is absolutely ridiculous. While, you know, that is ridiculous, what is true is that there sometimes is primary functionality associated with different parts of the brain. And the left side of the brain is where logic and reasoning happens. And that is also where verbal and speech centers sit. The right side is where the emotional processing happens. But when you ask someone a question about how do you feel, the left hemisphere, where the speech centers sit, raises its hand and says, well, I'm the speech center, so I will devise an answer. But the emotional processing is not really consulted on the very question of feeling. So you rationalize an answer that is appropriate for the target audience you're delivering it to, for the situation that you find yourself in, and you know, for something that's primarily a subconscious process anyway. And therefore, the stated response that you were talking about, or what we have gotten from surveys of focus groups for you know, the past 50, 60 years, is essentially very different from how people end up acting in the market. So how do we overcome that? We overcome that by using a very specific technology that we invented. It's called steady state topography, that measures the speed of the electrical activity in different parts of the brain as you're consuming any kind of content. So we stick electrodes in people's heads. So that people are wearing, you know, something that looks like a shower cap, and they're watching content. Even if it is a 30-second commercial, they're watching a 30-minute TV show. And it has regular ad breaks, four ad breaks with 12 different ads. And one of those ads, say, is an ad that we're trying to get in response to. And as people now receive that information, we're measuring the speed of electrical activity in different parts of the brain. And knowing which part of the brain does what, we can correlate it back to different physiological measures, such as what is going into long-term memory, what is personally relevant, what is emotionally engaging, what is a positive response or a negative response, a lean in or a lean back response, et cetera, et cetera. And because we're able to get a second by second response as people are receiving this information, we're then able to decode, okay, in this particular commercial, the idea of the father and the daughter worked particularly well with people. But by the time you came to a point in the story where we're talking about the brand, you had stopped the music and had a black screen on, and the brain stopped processing any information that you gave to people, thereby rendering this entire 30-second ad a useless exercise. So then what we're able to use that information for is to figure out the best places where a brand can be involved within a story so that it is saved with people's long-term memories as they're receiving this piece of information. So that's just one example of how we're able to, you know, take a traditional problem, use a modern day tool and solution, and then use that to actually create change in the stories that we're telling in market.
Thank you so much for that explanation. I'm really curious. So back in my early days of marketing, I had a job offer at Procter & Gamble to be a brand manager and have a budget to be able to have those user focus groups that you spoke of that we've been doing so long. I'm curious that the technology, the tool that you've created sounds amazing. Obviously, almost like a technical breakthrough to really understand what people are thinking. And I know that the way you described it is completely harmless. But I'm curious, when you reach out to businesses, Are they accepting of that technology? Are they able to bring in, you know, focus groups that are accepting of that as well? Or is there still some pushback you see?
I've never seen a pushback for this work purely because, you know, you can't possibly make people change how they think. They think how they think. You're giving them a survey to be able to figure out how they think. Now, by bringing me in, first of all, you're accepting that the survey is not giving you the truth. And all you're trying to get to is the basic truth that people are actually otherwise volunteering you to give you anyway on the survey. So that all this technology is doing is actually getting a response to something, which, by the way, you know, we live in a world where these same brands are working with the Facebooks and the Instagrams of the world, which are tracking a person's activity, who they're around, and listening to them on a 24 hours a day basis, versus comparing that to a 30-second brain mapping of how they respond to a particular TV ad. It's a completely non-threatening situation when you put it in context like that, and which is why we haven't really seen much of a pushback.
Well said. Thank you.
One question that I have would be, I can see how brands, like anybody that has a brand or company listening to this would be like, I would love to do this. This would save me so much time and energy. But in my experience and research, this is very expensive to do this kind of work. So what is, like, for the mid-sized company where budgets are not unlimited, like who are you dealing with now? And what is your advice to, because like I said, it's almost a chicken and an egg, right? Because it's very expensive to do, right? Still very expensive to do neuromarketing with this kind of technology. However, it's also very expensive to do, and I don't even call it marketing, but most companies are doing more of experimentation because they don't have the budgets to do full-blown marketing. So they're experimenting with a bunch of stuff that doesn't work. And then when it doesn't work, on the counter of that, that's wasting a lot of money too. So what is the, like, is there a happy medium, or what is your advice to people listening to this, the business owners that are like, yeah, I'd really like to do this. How much is it going to cost?
Yeah, well, I think you've answered the question yourself. I think the cost of wasting money on useless marketing is way higher than the cost of being able to make sure that whatever money you do spend works. And to be honest, this question for me is a strange one, purely because I am not only, you know, in an industry that's otherwise more expensive than the alternatives, I am the most expensive solution in this industry. And the reason why it is that is because we're the only people who can actually predict sales in market and how people are going to react to things with an 86% accuracy. Now, again, If simple math were to give you an answer, if traditional surveys correlate to in-market success at a 24% level, and your marketing budget is $5 million, I mean, by the way, my clients are all Fortune 100 companies, so they can spend $5 million on a campaign, let alone forget a marketing budget. And then, you know, if you have 20% chance of being able to be right there, and I give you an 86% chance of being right, how much money are you willing to spend to make that happen? A sixth grade math probability answer. And that's to the tune of millions of dollars more than I charge people. So it's expensive to actually bring people into a facility. To get a statistically significant sample of, you know, people's brains mapped, that's an expensive exercise to begin with. By the way, all universities who do any kind of neuro work, or actually other lesser neuromarketing companies, would actually do this with 12 people or 20 people, which any scientist will tell you is the most ridiculous thing to do, because it's not going to, you know, be predictive of anything in market. So we do not let go of the laws of statistics or real science to be able to do this. But of course, expensive exercise to do. My advice to people who don't have budgets like some of these companies is actually invest in just good marketers who understand the humanities and psychology, rather than actually do 20,000 surveys on SurveyMonkey that are not going to give you anything. I would save that money, give these people a raise, and give them the breadth and the freedom to be able to actually dig deeper themselves, because the answer is still going to come from the human. The answer will not come from the technology. My technology allows, in a systematic way to point out where the problem is. But the creative solution is still from the human. So at the lack of budgets, I would say invest in the humanities and encouragement of people to find creative solutions.
So what is your take then on this idea of partnering with forces of influence? So whether that be the stereotype of a content creator on Instagram or an expert in a niche field, how do you feel about that in terms of pump companies are like, well, I don't have the budget. So that's why a lot of people are jumping on this gun of like, well, let's just find somebody that does have the attention of my audience. And let's jump in bed together and try to get everybody we can.
Well, that jumping in bed together doesn't always work out in all aspects of life, because it requires good thinking and figuring out whether it's a good partnership or not. And in the world of influence, it's a game of borrowed equity, borrowed time, borrowed attention. Now, if you find someone who overlaps with your fundamental values and principles and attributes that are associated with your brand, enough to borrow and enough to still maintain your identity, it's great. But if all you ever want to do is get eyeballs, it's a bad partnership. And we've seen that happen. Like, we recently put out this study that we did with TikTok. And, you know, most of the results out there are public. So your audience can just Google NeuroInsight and TikTok and find the results. But one of the things that we do study is not just the quantity of impact, which is how, you know, media is bought and sold. How many followers do you have or how many people are you going to reach? But the quality of the impact. So when people do see that content, what impact is that having on them? So, you know, and by the way, this idea of influencer is not new either, right? In 7th, 8th century BC, there was this dude by the name of Shushrut, who was a physician, who wrote a treatise on Ayurveda, and essentially became, you know, of course, now it's on Instagram and TikTok, where people in California are asking you to have ghee or turmeric latte. It's a 3,000-4,000-year-old exercise where someone else has done it before. You know, you get to Socrates, Plato, Aristotle with their schools, you know, and the books that they published and the places that they reached, they were influencers in their time. All the guys during the Renaissance were influencers. I would call Einstein an influencer purely because he actually fundamentally changed how we thought about something that we now believe in enough to use it and teach it in schools, but actually sometimes don't have enough proof for it either. So it's not like he moved up from something that was objectively false, something that was objectively true, but he showcased through demonstration, through intellect, through creativity, enough things that made us shift our thinking towards something. So we've had these people forever, and different people will get associated with that idea of the influencer to borrow equity, and different levels of credibility are bought and sold using this platform. So I think the idea of it, again, has existed. The tools in the platform have changed, but brands are so out of ideas right now because it's the herd mentality. Today, what ends up happening is that they see this, that influencer marketing is giving them some ROI or giving someone else ROI on their dollars, and they jump into it without thinking too much. And the fundamental thing that needs to align is whether my values, my attributes, what I'm trying to be and who I am aligns with this person's way of being. If it is, it's always a good marriage. If it isn't, then, you know, it's a waste of money like everything else.
Pranav, thank you so much. When you said Northfield, Minnesota, I'm assuming Carleton College. I went to Amherst College. So I truly appreciate your understanding, love of liberal arts. I have two high school kids trying to push them in that direction. So I couldn't agree more. On that note, you know, your company has been around for more than a decade. I'm sure you have a lot of achievements. Is there a particular case study, whether anecdotally or maybe something I published, of a company that was wasting a lot of money, then worked with you and your company, and then found a breakthrough solution, a change in the way they did things that was very, very impactful? Is there any examples that you can share with us so we get a better understanding of the impact that your work has had?
Sure. I'm just trying to think about what I can talk about publicly. Let me use this one anecdotally.
Sure.
You know, one of the marketers I respect most in the industry is Nick Drake, who used to be the CMO of T-Mobile and is now VP of marketing at Google. And if you looked at all of T-Mobile marketing for the past decade, decade and a half, it was all offer-based. It was, you know, five lines for this price, add this to your family plan, you know, go into your store today, get this offer, and so forth. Or here's, you know, a picture of my map. You know, this is all the areas we're present, et cetera, et cetera. And while, you know, T-Mobile's growth has been incredible this entire time, you know, this company now had grown into a significant size and needed to talk about more things than just those offers. And under Nick's leadership, what we were able to do was to craft stories that were human, that spoke about the values that T-Mobile stood for, the joy it was able to bring to families, what connectivity does to it. So suddenly, from here's the cheapest offer on the table, the conversation was like T-Mobile was the enabler of human experiences, whether it was through a story of an estranged father and son who happened to come together on the birth of you know, this person's grandson, and how those, you know, calls and texts were exchanged, or this little kid who wants to play baseball in his mini league and plays with his friends, and the number of videos and the fails and the laughs that were shared over the group text messaging using that. So all of these stories, while, again, they were telling real human stories about families coming together around sharing, enabling life. Again, the brand was playing an instrumental role, but it basically attached brand to the values of these stories that were being told, which those offers really didn't have any of. So, you know, I'm one, you know, because we were able to see through that from the concept to, you know, the eventual Super Bowl creatives that were creative. I think T-Mobile put out three or four Super Bowl creatives that year. And all of them actually performed phenomenally well. So that was, you know, one piece of work that I'm very proud of, though, you know, we've, again, don't take on projects that we wouldn't be proud of. So there's plenty there, but just little I can share.
Thank you so much. I mean, this could be a multi-level podcast and many lectures and workshops in this, but we want to respect your time. And so for those that are curious to learn more about neuromarketing and especially the technology that you guys offer, where would you recommend going so that, you know, especially to look at, I think, case studies or examples, because I think that helps sort of the learning curve of what's possible.
Sure. On our website, there are plenty of resources, case studies, and we've actually recently started a blog to demystify some of the things around neuromarketing. Because one of the fundamental problems with the industry is that everything from eye tracking to skin response to facial encoding and a plethora of other biometrics are all clubbed within this umbrella of neuromarketing. And people actually have a hard time decoding which one to use or what gives them what. So we took it upon ourselves to actually educate anybody who wants to be educated. So all of those resources sit on the website, and people are more than, you know, as long as they follow us on LinkedIn or go to the website, there's enough resources there.
And your website is NeuroInsight?
Neuro-insight.com.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Pranav. Yeah, at the end there, I was going to say, hey, Pranav, let's dive into more about storytelling. And so we could have gone on and on and on like an onion as you peel every layer. There was so much more to talk about. So we might have to have you on in the very near future. But thank you so much for your time and the work that you're doing. I know this is going to be of great value to our listeners.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the School of Influence podcast. Amanda and Neil would be honored if you spend a minute to write a review wherever you are listening to this podcast to help expose these interviews to a broader audience. Make sure you hit the subscribe button so you don't miss out on future episodes. Even better, build your influence and ours by sharing this podcast on your favorite social media with hashtag School of Influence. We would love to hear from and engage with you.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, Tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.